Hey there, it's Max. Before we get started with the long-form podcast, I want to tell you about a new podcast that Aaron and I are working on. It's for the Cleveland Browns of the National Football League. Yes, that is a weird thing for me to have said, but it's true. For the entire 2015 NFL season, I'm going to be interviewing players and front office people and coaches and I think a couple of Hall of Famers for the Cleveland Browns about football, kind of, except I don't really know very much about football. So it's really going to be about lives off the field, what their jobs are like. The Browns have given me crazy access to the organization to make the show, and it's been really fun so far. I've met some fascinating people. There's going to be new shows throughout the season. The first one is up right now. It's BrownsCast. You can find it at BrownsCast.com. It's on iTunes. There'll be a link in the show notes. If you like long form, this is like that, except football, but not really. Here's long form.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm joined by my friends Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. They're from Longform.
Hey.
Hey, you guys.
How you guys doing?
We're not just co-hosts, we're friends.
That's new for me.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm glad that we've gotten to this place.
Cool, I'm glad we worked.
Big moment. 3 years and now we're friends.
Wow. Insane. Who could know by the time we hit episode 300 where this relationship could go?
Evan, I'm not going to ask you who's on the show this week because I know, because I've listened to it, and it's great. Tell us about it.
I appreciate that. It's great because this guest was great. It's Margo Jefferson. Margo Jefferson has been a critic for much of her career. She was a critic at the New York Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism there. She also was a critic at Newsweek, books, and arts in general. She was a critic at Vogue. More recently, she has written a memoir, which is called Negroland. It's about her growing up in Chicago and being part of what is goes by various names, but the black elite or the black bourgeoisie in Chicago. And she digs into sort of what that's meant for her and her life, and it's an incredibly fascinating book. I loved it.
Yeah, you had a lot of post-it notes in that copy.
This
there.
Is filled with post-it notes dog-earing as well.
What do those say on them?
They say, these are wise, I mean, they don't say anything, but they are marking wise passages where I just thought this writing is exceptional.
You must have done like really well in school.
Yeah.
I was a big Post-it, I guess. Does that really help you?
That was always my thing was, what am I going to do with all these post-it notes?
It's sort of an excuse for not remembering something almost, because I got all these post-it notes. So I could just go back and flip to each post-it note. I don't have to memorize anything.
I was at a beach house this weekend, and I opened a copy of Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire, which I've actually never read, though I do enjoy his writing very much. And it had written in the cover, overrated and self-masturbatory.
that was written on the
first page.
Oh, man, self-masturbatory is an incredible critique.
Yeah. Well, I think we should definitely invite Michael Pollan on the show to defend himself.
Yeah. For the record, I disagree with that review. Actually, it would be amazing if that was actually a signed copy and that's what he wrote.
Yeah.
Aaron, what about sponsors?
Our sponsor this week, of course, is MailChimp. As Tiny Letter was great for people, MailChimp is great for business. I use it for my business, Longform Newsletter. I believe Evan uses it for the Atavist newsletter. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Actually, I don't know anyone who uses any other mailing list service, which is an incredible testament, and that's corroborated by the 8 million lists that exist within the MailChimp ecosystem. I suggest you check them out. If you're starting a new list, it's free up until 2,000 subscribers.
But for now, here's Evan and Margo Jefferson.
Hello, Margo Jefferson. Welcome.
Oh. Thank you. Thank you, Evan.
I don't know anything about why books sell or are talked about, but this strikes me as a book that may be very talked about. So
well, all right.
I'm excited to talk about it.
Good.
So
me too.
I feel that it's a challenge to ask you about this book because I felt that when I read the book, I mean, you can look at my book, my copy of it, which I started dog-earing and then I realized I was going to destroy it. And then I went to Post-its. And then actually ran out of Post-its at the end. Like, there were so many things in this book to think about. I feel sort of unqualified to ask about them in certain ways.
But, you know, it's a cultural memoir.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I'm not a historian whom you are checking, you know, whose knowledge of facts, you know.
Right.
You're being
right.
Grilled true. About.
Yeah.
It is an experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When the book is called Negroland.
Yes.
And maybe you could just frame sort of how you would describe what Negroland is to you.
Yeah. Well, I picked that contentious word, Negro, capital N, may I make very clear, because I wanted something that was literal but metaphorical, too, to first of all signal a time period that's historical, that's etymological, that's cultural, you know, when people were called Negroes. What we're named, we being Black people, African Americans, Negro, colored people, you know, is kind of endlessly shifting, you know, and each era, each age has its preferred terms. And even, you know, certain insults that some are lasting, all but eternal, others fall out of usage, you know, and are replaced by other insults. But Negro was I'm the word of honor and choice in the world I grew up with in that particular period. And the book is really focuses a lot on the 50s and early 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, Negro first was capitalized, I think, the year I was born. So, you know, the word was, it was huge. And wow. You were always hearing, you know, worthy Negroes or not worthy Negroes. Or, you know, you can go back to old footage on TV and someone like Mike Wallace is saying, the young Negro musicians are very angry, you know, and it takes on this pointed, strange, you know, odd anthropological, you know, yes. thing. So I wanted... I thought, okay, it'll stir some animus, but I wanted all these associations and recollections and feelings to go. I picked land. This term came to my head, you know, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, because a land is real, but a land is also mythic, mm-hmm. you know, and this world, this space, this world that called itself and was called variously an elite, a bourgeoisie, an aristocracy, a middle class. Again, it's poised between Black life, white life, certain kinds of Black life, certain kinds of white life. So it's a borderland mm-hmm. in many ways.
Mm-hmm. It was so fascinating to read about the pressures that came from both sides, from being in that purgatory. I don't know if you would call it a purgatory, but being in this place where you are of an elite in one community, and then you have another community that sometimes doesn't even perceive
that you exist or have any right to exist.
Or you could have accomplishments or rights.
Yeah,
or
yeah. Well, let's see, purgatory. Were you raised Catholic?
No.
Oh. Purgatory is where you're being, isn't it? I wasn't either. You're being cleansed, kind of waiting to see if you'll go to heaven.
I guess you're waiting to see if you're going up or down,
up
so
or
to speak.
Down. Hmm. I'm going to think about that. Right. But this strange contended space, yeah, which could be very sheltered and lovely, but could be invaded at any time. Yeah.
And you sort of talk about navigating that and the difficulties of navigating that. And a lot of it is about the expectations that come from your parents and your family when you were growing up.
And you know, and from the history that they had, I don't know, assumed and imbibed and assimilated. You know, that's one reason I think of it as a cultural memoir, because just as, you know, Black and white and colored and, you know, those things keep diverging and merging, the cultural and the personal, you know, and by culture I mean everything from literally, you know, music or whatever, to, you know, practices, cultural practices, which include politics and the social. Those things kept, you know, kind of the personal and the cultural keep kind of mutating and mm-hmm. taking each other's places. It's the same thing with class and race and gender. They just keep taking on each other's disguises, or one will pass for the other, you
right,
know,
right.
Or, so.
And that was, I mean, the fact that it does contain this history. I mean, it's a, like, if you just look at the description of it, it says memoir, and then, but it starts in the 1800s.
And yeah, after that opening section that's personal, I then say, all right, I'm going to step back. You know, I'm going to erase myself and enter history.
Yeah,
that's right.
And it's not all personal history, although you do trace your
right.
own ancestors.
No, but it's quite a few pages of social, political, again, of cultural history.
And what was the sort of reasoning behind behind sort of starting it? There's a little preface, but like starting it at that point.
Okay. I think, there was a sense right immediately for me as a writer that, you know, the readers were going to need to be introduced in, really almost submerged in this world. Some would know, but still, I thought a real lineage was important, and I also thought there wouldn't be any other way to play out the contradictions and complexities. You know, if you have a so-called aristocracy that is also coming from, slaves and free people, and it's based on skin color, but also on accomplishments, and also on privileges you may get from white people around you who could also become your enemies at any time. You know, all of that, you need a map. The reader needed a map for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Certain information you had to travel with, I needed to get it clear from myself, too. It was my own history course, too. I thought, I can't be wanton about this,
Yeah. You actually have this, what I thought was a really wonderful passage where you're actually talking about, you sort of address who the reader is. And I was thinking of myself as the reader, like 40-year-old white man who grew up in the South.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Where? Which state?
In Atlanta.
Oh.
And reading
Margaret
the book,
Mitchell Land.
Yes. Yes. Although I've never seen Gone with the Wind or read it. Actually,
you're behind me in that case.
That's true. I guess when I was reading the book, I mean, part of what the book made me feel was ignorant of a certain slice of American culture and life that I felt like I should know more about and didn't.
But that's good.
It's very good. Yeah, but you had this section where it's a very elegant passage, which I might butcher, but I actually wrote down some of it, where you're talking about privilege and sort of white privilege and black privilege among this black elite, and that if you were an African-American person cleaning a house of a white person, would you rather be that, or would you rather be an African-American person cleaning the house of an African-American person? Like, and the actual question you ask is, whose privilege would you find easier to bear? And then right after that, you say, who are you? As in, who are you, the reader? How does your sociological vita, race, ethnicity, class, gender, family, history, affect your answer? And I was wondering, who do you think the reader is? Who were you writing to?
And now I'm going to jump back a little. All of these years that I've been a critic,
right.
I've had this awareness that I was often speaking without directly acknowledging that to extremely varied audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So I might be, particularly when I started writing cultural criticism, where you were kind of jumping from a specific art or experience to a larger, consideration or generalization. And I would say something, and I would think, my certain kind of white reader will interpret it that way. A certain kind of black reader will interpret it that way. I need to send some signals. Same with gender.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So, I've always been aware of that. Not always, I think, to my advantage. It can make you overly guarded and overly surreptitious in a way. I started at very traditional places and spent a lot of my life there. Newsweek, then The Times.
Right.
Those aren't places where, like, in the old Village Voice, you said, as a black woman of such and such generation, let me, or you might think, dear reader, that, I'm going to say that, but surprise, I'm going to say this. That wasn't permitted. I couldn't build that into something I was writing, so I would have to find other ways. So, sometimes I think I say towards the beginning, I'm kind of overwhelmed by thinking about who these readers yes. are and what they want from me, which is probably the first time I'd said something like that in print.
Oh,
absolutely. So, you know, that was one of those moments. My readers are Blacks of various, from various backgrounds, which makes big differences. Whites of various backgrounds, many others, you know.
Yeah, everything in between.
Yeah, you know, Latinas, Arabs, Asians, some of whom also have real points of connection with this, as, you know, because of those roles, double roles they're playing, often ethnically, racially, etc. So I realized all I could do so that I wouldn't keep second-guessing myself, as I felt I'd often done in my criticism, was at various points, you know, when the tensions became really strong and when I thought the subject, the moment was treacherous, like that moment when, you know, I, a person of privilege, am contemplating my cleaning woman, our family's cleaning woman, remembering my parents having that kind of discussion, and then exposing her, she's dead now, but exposing her, them, and, you know, to an audience of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I had to stop and say, oh, okay, wait a minute, take this in yourself. You know, let's each of us consider this. I'll take my responsibility for what I'm thinking. You know, step up and think about it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a kind of challenge, too.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here quickly to give you a word from our sponsor, Casper. What is Casper, you say? It is a new way to buy a mattress that in no way ever involves a mattress showroom. Thank God. You're going to go online, you pick out a mattress you like. The prices are outstanding. $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress, and these are no ordinary mattresses. They have just the right sink, just the right bounce. It's two technologies, latex foam, memory foam, that combine to make an incredible night's sleep. And best of all, once you get it, it comes in this cool box that does not look like it would fit a mattress, but somehow does. You open it up, you have 100 days to sleep on it. If you don't like it, send it back. It will not cost you a cent. Not even the shipping costs you a cent. So if you're in the market for a new mattress made in America for a great price without the hassle of a showroom, I'd love it if you would go to casper.com/longform. You're going to put in promo code longform. You'll get $50 off and support this show. Thank you, Casper. Here is Evan with Margo Jefferson.
You worked for so many years as a critic, as you mentioned, and I want to talk about that in a bit. Do you hear a critic's voice in your head when you're writing? I mean, everyone does.
Everyone does,
yeah. Is yours different, do you think, because you professionally criticized?
I don't know how different it is. It might move faster towards certain stern critical tones, i.e., you know, any writer is going to say in moments of despair, that's terrible, you know, I blew it. The critic might be more likely to say, that absolutely fails because, and then produce one of those analytic, you know, meticulous answers that may be true up to a certain point, but that can also be absolutely deadening. You know, the critic can always return to or resort to a kind of omniscient narrative. Narrator tone, and that can be very hard for the writer
right.
in you to counter.
Well, maybe particularly when you're writing something that is very personal.
Absolutely.
About your own history. What made you at this point in your life decide that now was the time when you wanted to take this on?
Well, you know, once I started this book writing thing, you know, when I first did the Michael Jackson book,
mm-hmm.
I realized, oh, all right, you know, books are interesting. I want to test this more. I want to do more with this. What do I do next? And if you're going to test a form, then you might as well test the role you play in that form. So, you know, I had done, actually, in around 2002, I had done a couple of theater pieces that trafficked in this material, you know, to some extent.
Like performances?
Yeah. Want to show that I did with my niece, who's a dancer and actor, and that we developed it at an institute that Anna Deavere Smith had, and then another that I did alone. And that was where I first tried out some of this material. I still don't know why it felt easier to do out loud in a performance, but it did. And, you know, once something is written down, and you've also performed it, it's there. So, you know, I couldn't forget it. It stayed interesting to me.
Did you take anything from the live audience? We just talked about not knowing who your readers are, really. Did you take anything from the live audience and how they responded to it? Or could you see and tell how they responded to it?
You know, with audiences, it's odd because you're feeling energy.
Mm-hmm.
More than, you know, unless you talk to people afterward. The audiences were quite mixed. So, you know, I felt the material was exciting to people. That I could take.
Yeah. There's a chapter on passing. It's some of your family members passed as white for much of their lives, and then one of them returned to the black community.
Great Uncle Lucius, after he retired from his job. Yes.
That chapter is unbelievable. I feel like when people talk about the, like, social construct of race, like, that chapter is just, you don't even have to say it. You could just read that. Was there a question of whether you felt you could write about that, write about your family, or did you feel like you owned that story and
I make clear in that I don't use any names except for my not passing cousin Lillian.
Right.
So I did actually feel, I felt, yep, I'm telling this, it's fascinating. But I did still feel I had to disguise, give them their disguises by the initials. A part of me even thought, well, who are these cousins? You know, who came looking, trying to track John Eddy, the other white cousin in that story. What, maybe they're out in the world. Maybe they have children.
Yeah.
But this, you know, this is something that I, part of the etiquette, if you will, of passing that I somewhat imbibed from my parents from this book. I remember in the 70s, so, you know, we've gone Black Power and everything. My mother, she and my father started telling many more stories about their old friends. And one of the stories that came up involved a white woman, so everyone thought, band leader, who'd been quite successful in the 40s. Well, it turned out she was black. And my mother and a group of friends who'd known her as a little girl in Chicago had all of this information and evidence, names, you know, changes. They tracked it all. And I said, I'm going to write an article about that and expose her. And my mother said, well, why would you need to do that? She may have family. You know, you just can think twice. And I realized, well, that generation, they were often very concerned about who you protected. So, you know, there was some interesting kind of loyalty that she was willing to extend to this woman, who will eventually show up in history, revealed as. But I thought, okay, mother. At the same time, you know, they would joke and mock and whatever.
But how did you process that as a younger person? You know, these relatives that you sort of find out about.
Well, Uncle Lucius was very interesting to me. I mean, he sat in our living room. I heard this story. You know, he didn't just look like a white man. Many people I grew up with did. He had been, you know. Right. So this was, so, you know, it's like, you know, the girl in The Exorcist, your head starts spinning around. And I was mesmerized. Was he a deeply interesting man, you know, in and of himself? Not necessarily, but, you know, my sense of drama was absolutely riveted. It wasn't talked about a lot. Maybe in some families it was, because some were, you know, very proud of this or joked about it a lot or had really lots of relatives who crossed back and forth. This wasn't talked about a lot in my family at all.
It feels like you're playing with form a lot in this.
Thank you.
I am.
I really appreciate that. Yes.
Well, one of the things you do is you sort of step back. And so you'll describe an incident, let's say, an incident where you were subject to discrimination or a sort of slur, whether inadvertent or intentional, when you were a kid. And then you step back in the next chapter and say something like, I think it's too easy to recount unhappy memories when you write about race.
Yes.
And I'm interested in that interplay of pulling back and why and how you set those boundaries. How do you structure something like that?
Over and over and over. Right. You just keep. One of the things about working with a memoir-esque form was I really wanted to get those changes of mind and mood, these mood swings that, mm-hmm. And tone swings that are so much a part of our daily lives, but aren't necessarily what a memoir narrator is most involved in. But that really fascinated me, partly because it gives you so much drama, and also because partly it seemed true to my own temperament and voice as a writer, but also formally. Mm-hmm. That was just really interesting. I was able to play around with things that I just hadn't been before as a writer. Also that kind of hyper self-consciousness, you know, this is terrible, look what happened, I'm fine. You know, no, all right, it was an unpleasant remark, but you know, now we're going to go to a splash party together and everything's going to be fine. Yeah, that was very, very characteristic of the world, my world, my training, mm-hmm. How I was trained to function successfully,
mm-hmm.
You know, and navigate and negotiate all these shifts of consciousness, of perception, of race awareness, of acceptance and non-acceptance.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, that seemed like the most difficult and debilitating part of being in this world, not being able to trust how people were responding to you at different times.
I think that's right. Or you trust it, and then suddenly the response changes.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, am I a fool to have trusted this? Or did this person really not expect this thing to happen? So, you know, how do I reconfigure? Do I hold the grudge? Do I bury it? You know, do I try to rise above it? And what do those choices make of me and of the other person too?
Right. Yeah.
And of the structure we're all part of.
And it reminded me a little bit of David Carr's memoir. I don't know if you read it, called The Night of the Gun.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't, but I know.
In a way, he's...
Tell me more.
Well, so he's writing, I mean, it's an addiction memoir.
Yes, this I did know.
But he often will pull back and say, addiction memoirs always go this way, or
okay.
This is what an addiction memoir would typically, this Dude. Is what typically would happen, and this is the arc of that story, and I'm trying to tell you a different story, or I'm trying to escape from that.
Right.
And
a pattern of expectation and of narrative. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And I felt that same, it felt like you were maybe trying to not write a certain kind of book.
Well, you know, maybe what you're saying in a way is, and I think there's truth to this, one of the problems with burdens of race conversations in this country is certain ideological and narrative, and, you know, political, sociological narratives that keep getting imposed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I said repeated expectations. You know, this is where the conversation should go. These are the roles we need. This is what, in a way, this is the comfort level of my discomfort, even. You know, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, if we're talking about it this way, you know, that's the net. I can contend with that.
Right. I know the parameters of this discussion.
Exactly.
This is not going to escape into an uncomfortable place.
That's right.
For me.
That's right. So that's a very interesting comparison. Yeah, maybe we're all somewhat addicted. I think we are to certain racial conversations, you know, with their limitations and their conventions.
I was reading an interview that you did with a playwright a few years ago, and you asked this lovely question, which I'm going to steal from you, which was, what writers were you in conversation with in writing this book? And you were asking this of this playwright. I thought that's actually a brilliant way to ask that. Like, what writers were in your mind as you were writing this book?
Well, some of them found their way onto the page,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Baldwin, like I steal that line from Virginia Woolf, what governs people's, you know, hate, despair, I've blocked it out. I've used it so much. And I used it in, you know, and then all those usually women that I stole those despair quotes from.
Yes. You know? That's right.
So I was in open conversation with them. But I think, again, I was so grappling with memoir. What did I know? I didn't know memoir very well, but I was entering it. I knew reviews extremely well, but I knew essays. So I found that the works that have more directly to do with that were eccentric memoirs that involved a lot of digressions, you know, mm-hmm. or essays that, you know, the personal essay. I really, really admire Richard Rodriguez's, mm-hmm. you know, call them autobiographies, call them memoirs, you know, but one is more on education, one is more the public and the private worlds of straight, gay, Mexico, the U.S., etc. The third is race and ethnicity, that, you know, and they're essays that join together in such odd and tremendous ways. I loved that. I love how Hilton Alls's books, like, you know, The Women or White Girls, you know, always, you know, contain some wild cultural take that is very, very intimate. You know, so there's confession and obsession and analysis. That was very interesting to me. I had not read Mary McCarthy's, you know, Notes from a Catholic Girlhood mm-hmm. In years, but it kept coming back to me because that was the first book I remember reading where a very confident memoirist openly disputed her own memories.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And allowed for that doubling and that self-critical vulnerability.
Right.
So
yeah.
That was... And interesting to me.
It gets, the book gets to very intimate places or vulnerable places when you talk about depression, and I had never heard depression framed this way. You say something like, for black women, depression was sort of like the privilege that you could never have. Like, that was a privilege that white women had that you weren't allowed to have.
It's true. For one thing, it can feel... because it's very tied to the kind of melancholy that comes from this struggle, this constant, I am proving myself. It can feel like a respite. All right. You know, I'm not responsible to that functioning, successful persona. No.
Mm-hmm.
No expectations can be put on me. I am in my chosen study, sell, you know, this is not too high a price to pay. It's a respite. Maybe that's a better word than rest. And it also gives you utter privacy mm-hmm. in a strange way. The other thing I was talking about in that comparison was, you know, the very different mythologies that white and black women, you know, have contended with. And, you know, there is a certain glamour, you know, to the Sylvia Plath narrative, the Virginia Woolf narrative, the artistic, lovely, you know, gifted white woman, you know, who's almost too sensitive for this world amidst her gifts. You know, and it can be, God knows what it cost them. We do know. But it has had a certain, you know, glorification.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what was the lineage that I as a black woman got? You must struggle to overcome all the time. You know, you must be perfect. You will not really be fully acknowledged for this, but you must never, ever stop working for it. And no, you know, do not admit that you are vulnerable. That is closed from your vocabulary, okay? So those are expressive constraints as well as high demands.
Those feelings, I mean, you talk about feeling this depression and even suicidal tendencies, or exploring that in
yes.
the 70s,
and dramatizing them in a way,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
But this is in a time period when you're already starting to be successful in
it's
your
true.
Career.
Yes, it's true.
And I'm curious, the book gets in, it comes up to the present day in a way, but it doesn't explore sort of how your professional career started. And I know that...
No, it doesn't.
You went to Columbia Journalism School.
Right.
You went to Brandeis.
And then a couple of years later, the J School. Right?
And then how did you get your start as a journalist?
The first piece I ever published was about rock and roll. In Harper's,
yes,
the year
I have
after.
It right here.
Oh my God. And I had worked on that.
1974?
I think 72.
72?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think it's 72.
All right. I had first worked on that at Columbia with a very good New Yorker writer who was my teacher. So I'd done a version of that. Columbia in those days was a very good old boy network. Hmm. And if you were a girl, you could still profit.
Oh, you could.
And,
they let
and
you...
a black girl, you could still profit from the white old boy network. So someone at Columbia put me in touch with Lewis Lapham. You know, so you can send a query letter. So I sent the letter. He published the piece.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one piece, and then you start to freelance for other places. I went to Newsweek in 73.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then I was always a little restless places. So then I left and freelanced for a while and taught at NYU. And, you know, the freelancing was not wanting to have more than one voice. As soon as I left Newsweek, I started writing for places like The Nation and The Voice, you know, where, of course, you could work in ways, you know, in terms of the pieces you did, the subjects, and your voice that I hadn't done at Newsweek.
Mm-hmm. That's the freedom of the freelancer.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, and the choices you make. Then I taught and went back and forth, went to Vogue, was pre-Anna Wintour as a contributing editor. And then I think my first links to the Times were writing for the Book Review.
Yeah.
And then that's how we started negotiations.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to get too far away from this Harper's piece before we talk about
sure.
it for a second, because I read it and it was fascinating.
Oh, I was in my incendiary.
Yeah. Do you remember this piece?
Yes. the rock and roll is the minstrel show, right?
Yes.
Yes, of course.
But I found so many echoes in here to conversations that happen today around hip-hop and white artists in hip-hop. The same.
It's true.
Same conversations.
No, it's really true. Yeah, and there's even a critique, and I actually wrote about this at the Times. There's even a critique among many black critics who don't like hip hop, who will up the critique up, calling it a kind of minstrel show, black minstrel show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, blacks can play minstrels as much as whites. Goes the yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it goes on. It goes on around people like Miley Cyrus, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Do you remember what sort of instigated the idea?
I've kind of been brooding over it, and with a lot of mixed feelings, all of which didn't find their way into the piece. I liked Janis Joplin, but I would get furious, you know, when critics would say, oh, you know, this is the most soulful music you're going to find. Yeah, I loved that Jimi Hendrix was all over the map. But I loved I loved that he was this black guy in this world that everyone thought, this music world that everyone thought was white. You know, so, you know, I was kind of in turmoil about all of this. You know, I think it was a sort of mirror of, or a reflection of, or an objective correlative for a lot of things I was, you know, thinking about and contending with, just in terms of cultural race, you know, conundrums and relations and all of that.
And
yeah.
the appropriation. I mean,
yes, that's right. And who was allowed to appropriate what? And for example, you know, being a member of the bourgeoisie, we were often, in those days, if you were a pop critic, you would often sneer at what looked like too sophisticated black pop, you know? Absolutely. Oh, my God, you know, that day. Or jazz musicians who seemed, you know, even someone like John Hammond. You can find old quotes of his where, oh, such and such musician, you know, oh, he's from a middle-class family. He's a little too prissy. Da, da, da. This is, you know, it's Frankie Newton. I mean, it's some wonderful musician. You find it in critiques of gospel music among critics who really like the quartets, but the women are too too baroque, you know, in their styles. It's all too... So, you know, I was very interested in all those double standards of appropriating downward versus appropriating upward, and, you know, why it was always considered, it seemed to me, authentic if you were white and being soulful. But, right. you know, the limits of authenticity were much stricter if you were a black artist.
Yeah. I was reading about that Lynn Povich book that's about
the Newsweek book. Yes.
Yeah, about the Newsweek lawsuit.
Yes.
And the Times Review, actually, from a few years ago, says they filed this lawsuit. I think it's the Times Review. It says they filed this lawsuit. And the person who got a job as a result of this lawsuit was Margo Jefferson.
As a result of that lawsuit, I think what the Times said was, you know, various people. Because as a result of the lawsuit, some women were promoted from researchers to reporter. Other women were hired.
I see.
And I was one of the ones who was hired. And I think that what the Times reviewers said was something like, you know, in fact, one of the, you know,
women who profited from this was Margo Jefferson,
who later became a cultural critic at this magazine. But was I, in fact, a direct beneficiary of this threatened lawsuit? Absolutely.
And but you weren't part of the lawsuit.
No, I wasn't there yet.
Yeah, so you got hired, right?
Obviously, I benefited from it. That's right.
But part of what I wanted to ask...
But Lynn was one of those, you know, who was, I think, promoted because of it. Yeah.
So, I see. Yeah. So, but you went to work with those people.
Absolutely.
Yes.
They were all still there.
And, I mean,
very grateful to them, yes.
Yeah, it's still sort of a... seems absurd that that had to happen at that point in...
History, you know, they weren't the only magazine or newspaper threatened with lawsuits in terms of race and gender. Yeah.
But another thing I wondered was just maybe I read that I sort of misread that Times thing a little bit, but I actually wondered if it's sort of irritating to be called out in that way. You know what I mean?
They said there's a lawsuit
and that's how you got your job.
You know, the day I was being interviewed by Jack Kroll, in fact, for the job, another writer came in, and he said, "Oh, I know you. You know you. I know you from Columbia. You were." And he named my movie writing teacher. He said, "Oh, you were Judy Crist's favorite student, or best favorite student." I said, "Oh, sweetly." And he said, "Oh," he said, "you know, I tried to get my best student a job here, but I couldn't because he wasn't black or a woman." And he said this in front of the editor, the arts editor who was interviewing me. And I looked at him, and Jack did something to change the subject, and I got the job, and I thought, okay, that is so ugly. I am never, you know, I know how good I am. I'm never going to try to cover up that I wouldn't have been able to show how good I am without, you know, these attacks, these challenges to the system.
Right, never would get in the door.
Exactly.
Did you ever go back to that person and say, "Would you like to see my Pulitzer Prize?"
We haven't seen each other over those years. Oh, it's been a long time after I left Newsweek. I never saw him again. So, you know, do I sometimes get irritated? There's a tone people can take or a, you know, I know sometimes people say, "Oh, that's, she's good, but that's why she got the Pulitzer." You know, that kind of thing. But, you know, the historical facts of it, no, I'm not going to dispute those. People need to remember them. Yeah.
All right. That's exactly what I was wondering.
Yeah, but what they say if I'm behind my back sometimes, God knows.
So as you gravitated towards doing criticism and you started working at the Times and, you know, you were doing, it seemed like largely book criticism, but
yes,
also other type of arts.
That's what I'd really been doing. I've been hired at Newsweek as a book critic, and most of the freelance work I'd done had been books. So that's what I was hired to do it. At the Times, and then I started pushing to do more performance, you know, and you know, these days, thinking of cultural connections is really interesting. I mean, even with theater, so much theater is busy borrowing from film, and you know, you just have to. And that is intellectually and temperamentally just really, it always excites me, you know, how things connect or conflict or whatever. So that's why I... you know, kept lobbying for a slightly larger territory to play around with.
And is that what drew you to criticism in general? I mean, is a particular slice of journalism and writing, and what do you think went into your both desire to and aptitude at doing criticism?
I've always been good at seeing, oh, this, but on the other hand, well, let's come up with a third view, you know, a kind of parsing different sides of something. That can make you a real wimp. And I'm, you know, oh, well, we don't need to disagree why she feels and he feels. And so I think it was very good that I had a stringent streak that meant I had strong judgments about things. So mm-hmm. I think that combination did probably serve me well. Why did I want to be a critic? I think I wanted to get to the center of the culture and feel I had a voice and some authority there.
Mm-hmm.
And some control, internal as well as external, I think.
Did you feel that at the Times? Like the Times, especially then, it was the center of the universe.
Yes, it's true. It's certainly power. Once you're at any very powerful institution, you, of course, are very aware of what is permitted and what's not permitted. Certain examples of the power, I mean, I loved the power of being read a lot, but I did not actually enjoy the power of possibly being able, unless I thought it was egregious and evil, close down a show or kill book sales. Or you know, that didn't feel quite cricket to me, actually.
I couldn't find any vicious reviews of your. I read a lot of them. I couldn't.
I don't think I found was someone's vicious, but I could be quite harsh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you remember any
stern?
any show in particular that you closed down or a book that you eviscerated?
I'm not sure I did, because it turns out a number of things you think you have power over, you don't. I couldn't have closed down an Andrew Lloyd Webber show to save my life, and I hated them. No, but there was nothing I could do. You know, by the time I got to the Times, actually, the culture, movies, but certainly TV, but plays too. You know, the big hits were almost impervious to what a critic thought of them, except, you know, in terms of intellectual discourse. But financially, not really. Yeah. So I guess I would say that sense that yours, because it was the Times voice, was always ipso facto the most important, that unsettled me sometimes, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And you won a Pulitzer in
1995. I did, 95, yeah.
And
that was mostly from my book writing. I had just started the theater work when I got the Pulitzer.
Yeah, yeah. So I read all those pieces, and It seemed like then, I mean, there's some echoes in it, your book, because you're weaving together a lot of larger cultural ideas into the reviews. And I was curious if you sort of felt like you were engaged in a larger project around these pieces, or if really the task at hand was, someone has to review this book, I want to review this book.
Look, there's always sometimes, I want to review, I just want to do this, you know. But you know, ever since when I'd started at Newsweek, I had a kind of a mandate for myself, and it was twofold. And one thing was, I really do want to pay attention to books that aren't going to be probably attended to by my colleagues. And those were often books by people of color, books by women, you know, even strange, you know, historical little patches here and there. I remember doing a 2 or 3 volume biography of Eleanor Marx, the youngest daughter of we know who. and at the same time, I said to myself, as Gilbert and Sullivan put it, you know, no, I'm not going to be the, oh, she does the blacks and the people of color and the women. That's what she does. That's fine. That's her beat. There are all sorts of things in the culture that I'm fascinated by, and I am claiming, you know, all of that too, or any part of it that I want, and I'm going to do both of these things. And that really stayed with me. That's been something that's, you know, I've always felt.
Did you feel that pressure, either implicitly or explicitly at places, to say, like, you're covering this? body of literature?
It's sometimes it's there by default. I would say rarely explicitly. You know, it was more just kind of the way things would fall out if you were not careful. If you didn't want to be sure. By the time I got to the Times, less so. I would say it was truer in the 70s, probably, and 80s. And sometimes it would simply be what books you were offered.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Oh, I remember an editor I shall not name asking once, and this would have been a freelance assignment. It was not the Times. Are you interested in a piece on Doris Day? And I said, well, in fact, yes. And the next thing I knew, a distinguished white male novelist, better known than I was at that time, had written about her, but you know, he certainly didn't write about music or entertainers nearly as much as I did. So I thought, well, it was as much a stretch for him.
Right.
Why not give me the piece? So periodically, but you know, once I established that, it became a strength of mine, mm-hmm. actually, and it was useful.
Mm-hmm.
One piece, though, I was asked to do, and that was actually at the Times. It was Marian Anderson's something-something anniversary, maybe mm-hmm. anniversary of the birth, and would I do a piece on her? And I said, you know, I really don't think this is a good idea. I don't have credibility as a classical music critic. You know, I only write about classical music. I allude to it, mm-hmm. and it won't be. She, you know, she was a major opera singer. She deserves to be taken totally seriously. And if I write about her, it will look like, you know, a kind of quote affirmative action, you know, piece of condescension. So, one of the white classical music critics wrote the piece, and that was much more appropriate.
Mm. And why did you leave the Times?
I was working on the Michael Jackson, mm-hmm. and I realized I want to focus my writing energies on, because all these years I'd also been struggling with these, the distribution of energy that working and contending with melancholia and death thoughts will impose on you. You've got to be careful about your energies and resources. So I thought, I want to work on books and essays. And I'd always been trying, often with these shorter pieces, to make them more essayistic. Mm-hmm. But I thought, I don't do long forms. Let me see what happens.
And the Michael Jackson book was the first. Was that the longest thing you'd written since the Harper's piece?
Maybe not the longest, but you know what most of the pieces you write for. Certainly my Newsweek pieces were quite short. I don't think I wrote longer than 2,500 words for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the long pieces.
We don't have to get too far into the Michael Jackson book, but it's called On Michael Jackson, right?
That's that kind of essayistic, I'm being contemplative. It's a little self-important, I admit.
I like it. But I think that one of the interesting things about it was, as a critic and as an essayist, if high and low even mean anything as cultural terms anymore, you travel very easily between them.
Thank you. Good.
And
I want to, yeah.
But was there a risk? Did you feel like, to your criticism of higher art forms, to, say, write a book about Michael Jackson, did you feel a career risk in that?
No. But as it turned out, there were people, I was surprised. People would come up to me very, very politely at readings, and they would say, they'd be in polite distress. They'd say, I've admired your work for so many years, and, you know, this was really well written, but why did you decide to write a book about Michael Jackson? You know, I mean, look at what you've done.
What would you say?
You know, I never quite had I would say I wanted to, or I'd say, you know, he's a genius, and he's deeply troubled, and he also embodies so many troubles and horrors and conflicts in American culture. I think, actually, had I been able to complete the book earlier, before all, you know, of the scandal and horror descended on him, he would have had more credibility. But mm-hmm. by the time my book came out, you know, please, Michael Jackson.
Right.
You know, he was an object of certainly still passion for the diehard fans, but also a lot of contempt, disdain, and squeamishness.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just, that was timing. I just wish I'd finished it earlier. Once he died, or after he died. Now I'm talking like a crass author. Because as soon as he died, it became possible for so many more writers and critics again to look back. I mean, that's just the way we all are.
Oh, that's interesting. While he was still alive, you sort of had to grapple with the more disturbing things that happened at
the end. And filter it through often, yeah.
All right. Oh, fascinating. So you wrote the book and you also teach.
I do, yeah.
And I'm curious how you feel criticism fits into the current sort of cultural world with the web and with social media and the kind of criticism you've done for your whole career. What do you think the role is? And you have students who obviously you talk to about their writing. Do you have a perspective on sort of how the internet fits into that world?
For students, the one way in which it really doesn't work for them is it almost never pays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but its presence, gives them lots of options, and there's a lot of really good stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of crap. There's plenty of crap in the larger, in the offline world. So that really doesn't worry me. There are moments when we all feel, meaning from a first-year graduate student to me, oh my God, are we going to be rendered obsolete? Because, if you and your friends and a few other people you're following and respect, can have all the conversations, then there's a glut. You're not going to want to keep. But most professions have some version of that kind of challenge. I don't have I'm moseying along. I like the fact that so many people feel some version of critical response is essential to them, that it feels kinetic and exciting. There used to be, when I was coming along, criticism was still, as it had been for decades, even centuries, the kind of, it's the second, it's the art, it's the form that feeds on mm-hmm. greater forms. It's a little stiff. It's, yes, it can be very impressive, but it often didn't feel essential. And a lot of it does now, and I like that.
It's sort of the central mode of web writing in a way. Is criticism or, examining whether other web ideas or other forms of art and saying your opinion about them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, even all the stuff about the number of opinions that have surfaced in, was it 24 hours about Kanye West for president?
But, the VMA Awards
speech. I have nothing to add on that. But I just thought, at first I looked at it, I thought, wait a minute. And then I read something else and, something kind of interesting about politics and pop culture. I thought, all right, so, it's a way of working the muscles.
I'm sure you have something to add on that. You have a story about Beyonce in the current issue of Vogue.
That's in Vogue. It's true. But I getting ready for that story, I know her oeuvre better than I know Kanye's at this point. I do.
How did that assignment come about?
Well, actually, it came about because my agent had submitted my book to Vogue for a possible excerpt.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer came back, we were sorry to pass on it, very nice, it's elegantly written. Would Margot Jefferson be interested? And I had written for Vogue years ago. Be interested in writing an essay on Beyonce for our September issue. And I said, Margot Jefferson would. Yes, she will and she would.
Done.
Yeah.
You mentioned in the Michael Jackson book, the sort of like when it came out and when an author wants a book to land. And so your book now is coming out amidst a lot of discussion at Black Lives Matter and everything that's going on in terms of police brutality, police shootings.
And a general sense that it's part of that is, what do we mean when we talk and think about? And, about race and prejudice and, you know, how does it manifest itself? What are all, how do all these structures reveal it or, and oppose it? And so, you know, there's a real attempt, I think, to get more at systemic matters and also to really push language and thinking about it. Yeah.
And but presumably when you finished the book, that conversation, I mean, obviously that conversation's always happening.
Yeah.
But it wasn't happening at the level that it is now.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, so that feels to me, oh, my goodness. You mean from my selfish, self-centered office perspective?
Yeah, it just reads like you're catching a wave of conversation at the right time.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I like that. You know, it allows real responses to my book, and it allows me to keep generating responses, you know, to what's going on and to think of, you know, what I write, what I respond to, what I speak of next.
For me, at least, it gives it even a different context than if I had read it at a different period where I wasn't already thinking about this a lot. It actually caused me to respond to the book maybe differently than I would have otherwise.
And when you say differently, what do you mean?
I mean that thinking about the whole history, that there's these sort of events that happen in the news and they pop up and they become flashpoints.
Yeah.
But the fact that your book sort of starts back and really says, this is the cultural history of how I ended up in this place.
Yeah.
I feel
like
thinking of it in that way, thinking that every one of these events has a deep history to it.
Yes.
It was an interesting way to think about it.
That is broad, but that is very particular.
Right.
And personal, and could be happening, you know, to the person across the desk from you, across the room from you, and in school with your child or your sister or your brother. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously it gets very intimate in terms of parts of your life, and we talked about how it sort of pulls out from that and plays with the form, but just in terms of having people know those things about you, how do you prepare yourself for that?
Well, time helps, because I actually started on this book, you know, around 2009, 10. So I had a lot of time to prepare myself. And, that, you know, as you keep writing and rewriting and thinking, as you do sometimes, do I really want to do this? You know, then of course that's one of the things that comes up. It was a struggle. I knew it would be, you know. And some of these, I'm writing about things that are embarrassing or make me ashamed, or that I've always, you know, had an attractive cover for. Am I willing? And, you know, each time you ask, you know, you get closer to what your answer is. So I thought, I am.
And did you feel like, you mentioned, there's a, just a side note, you mentioned, or not a side note, but sort of comes up, like, that's what my therapist tells me. That comes up at one point, and maybe 2 points in the book.
I mentioned therapist and the psychopharmacologist.
Did writing the book feel like a form of therapy?
Writing a book like this, it is a process. And so, you know, you're always rethinking, refeeling, reconfiguring, you know, everything in your life, from, you know, the people you're involved with to the therapist you're involved with, contributes to that. But working with form also makes a huge difference. The literary formal choices you make, and then making them again, and then asking yourself, which is a technical question, but technique is often so tied to these other emotional questions of what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. You know, that's particular to writing.
And you have this one chapter that I felt like this must have been, it would be very difficult for anyone to write, that's just almost just about personal appearance and beauty, and like describing yourself.
Yes. And my sister. Yeah.
Yeah, and your sister.
You know, some of it was funny, though, too, in a grim kind of way. Grim, grisly are strange words for those female whatevers. But, you know, if you reread it, you'll see that there is something wickedly deadpan about it, too, even as it is. You know, I kind of wanted it to have the precision of a, you know, very well-appointed, almost horror story. So, you know, it's also so exact that it was almost easier to write in some ways. You know, it's all a part of any woman of my generation, whatever her race, class, whatever, was just, you know, immersed in, indoctrinated with, you know, all these obsessive details about her looks, her appearance, her body, her clothes. You know, it's very natural.
Yeah, you're talking about nose shapes. You want to have this nose shape, not that nose shape. A little bit this way. It's okay if it's this.
That's right.
It's okay if the nostrils flared, but it has to be this.
That's right.
Precise.
Very precise. That's right. Almost scientific, yes.
And your sister, is your sister's?
She is not. She's not. My sister was the director of the Alvin Ailey School.
Ah.
She was very cool. But she died of ovarian cancer in 2010, really shortly. She was getting sick just as I was really starting the book, which may have also helped, after she died, impel me to keep finishing it, not in some sort of, this is for Denise, but just in an additional sense of, and my mother was getting older, not, and they will love every word I wrote, but, you know, it's disappearing. Let me shape it. Let me, you know, record and imagine, you know, and reimagine and imagine what it was.
Yeah, and she seemed like the person who no one else had your experience, but she had the closest thing to your experience.
Yes.
Going to those
almost
all white schools and camps.
Exactly. She and a little group of friends from Chicago, and two of them, you know, the two I'm closest to are the other two dedicatees of the book.
Have they read it? Has anyone read it?
Most of it, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're excited. Yeah.
Well, the thing I wanted to close with was just, I found it was actually one of the things you won the Pulitzer for. This is like, I feel like I'm about to do what I think is like a critic's worst nightmare.
Oh God!
I kind of hope it's a critic's worst nightmare in a way. But I found this review of yours that's about this woman Lucy Greeley's book called Autobiography of a Face, which sounds like an incredible book.
It is, actually.
And you say, so many memoirs make you feel that you've been sealed up inside a wall with a monomaniac. And you want to say that this one's not like that. And you say, in this book, you're not just seeing the writer, you're not just trying to see yourself, you're seeing the world in a different way. I thought your book embodied that idea.
Thank God.
And
yes. I wanted it so to do that. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Were you afraid that it would read like you were sealed up inside a wall with a monomaniac?
I wouldn't say a monomaniac, but I might say, a compulsive egotist, precious egotist. I honestly don't think I'm a narcissist, but I felt it would be easy to write in a way where someone could see it. Or, you know, that bubble of privilege makes her, you know, really think she can't think beyond herself. And those things were frightening to me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I worked against them in every way I could as a writer and as the person who writes. But, again, I think that's one reason that I kept varying the strategies, the devices, the forms, you know, so that the points of view, the levels of consciousness and my role could change,
mm-hmm.
keep changing and that the world could advance often.
Well, I think it's a remarkable book, and I thank you so much for coming to talk to me.
Oh, this was great. Thank you.
That's it for this week's Longform Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from Longform. Many thanks to Margot Jefferson for coming into the studio. She was really fun to talk to, and her book, which is called Negroland, is fantastic. You should go buy it right now. Thanks to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman. Thanks to our intern, Molly Bain. You should also check out the new podcast that Max and Aaron are working on. It's with the Cleveland Browns. There's a link in the show notes. If you like sports, if you like interesting people, I think you'll like it. Thanks, as always, to our sponsor, MailChimp, and we'll see you next week. No.